of our world and ourselves. Respecting our biologically programmed need for play can transform work. It can bring back excitement and newness to the job. Play helps us deal with difficulties, provides a sense of expansiveness, promotes mastery of our craft, and is an essential part of the creative process. Most important, true play that comes from our own inner needs and desires is the only path to finding lasting joy and satisfaction in our work. In the long run, work does not work without play. It should be obvious by now that play outside of work is undoubtedly a good thing. Play is called recreation because it makes us new again. It recreates us and our world. As Laurel demonstrated when she began riding horses, just a little true play in one's life can bring everything else, including work, back in balance. A good vacation, one that is not an endless logistical chore of packing, driving, flying, and organizing activities, one that allows us to indulge in activities that we truly love, can also have a transformative effect. When people come back to work from true play vacations, they are eager and energized for work. Play is nature's greatest tool for creating new neural networks and for reconciling cognitive difficulties. The abilities to make new patterns, find the unusual among the common, and spark curiosity and alert observation are all fostered by being in a state of play. When we play, dilemmas and challenges will naturally filter through the unconscious mind and work themselves out. It is not at all uncommon for people to come back not only re-energized, but also with fresh ideas for work. All it took for Carl was one day away from the job. Feeling overworked and blocked in his job as an administrator at a hospital, he decided on the spur of the moment one morning to take a vacation day and work out his frustrations on the racetrack. The local Malibu Grand Prix offered unlimited laps in their small, gasoline-powered race cars for $25 on Thursdays, and he spent all morning hugging the tight turns and zipping through the straightaways, trying to get his mind completely away from work, watching his lap times drop with each revolution. Around mid-morning, though, he seemed to have hit a plateau. His times went up or down a few tenths of a second each lap, but they didn't drop, no matter how perfect he made his line through the turns. So he tried driving really aggressively, punching into each curve, coming out of each turn on the edge of a four-wheel skid, alternatively popping the brakes or hammering down the accelerator as needed. And his times dropped. He didn't objectively feel that the car was going faster, but the emotion that he was driving with seemed to push through invisible barriers. By early afternoon, Carl felt hot and sweaty, but paradoxically cleansed and relaxed. He had successfully rid his conscious mind of any thoughts of his work, but strangely enough, as he pulled into the pits for the last time, he had an epiphany about work. He realized that he had been working too hard to get consensus on every project. I realized that sometimes people don't want to be part of the decision-making process, he told me. If someone doesn't have a strong opinion, trying to get buy-in is like stacking Jell-O cubes. Carl realized he needed to punch through the twists and turns of the hospital bureaucracy with the intention and directness he brought to the racetrack. In solving the problems of his lap times, Carl's playing mind connected with the solution to a problem that was much more important. Play at work. Can play at work itself be useful, though? I would argue that it is essential. First of all, when the going gets tough, the tough go play. Talk to firefighters or police officers, and they will tell you that joking around, razzing one another, and practical jokes are just part of the job. Their dark humor often helps them cope with the inherent dangers of their work. If you might die on your shift, it doesn't increase effectiveness to dwell on that fact too much. It's an understandable reaction to become obsessive about the many ways to kick the bucket. But by so doing, this preoccupation would most likely cause a freeze-up in the face of danger. Martha Gellhorn, a journalist who at one point was married to Ernest Hemingway, said that as a war correspondent, she got a quick picture of how the war was going in Vietnam when she sat in a mess hall with a group of American officers. Gellhorn had seen combat as a journalist in World War II. She landed in France shortly after D-Day, and in the Korean War. The best officers, she observed, had a certain swagger and bonhomie about their deadly work, a joie de vivre, or joie de combat. As she sat at the mess hall in Vietnam, and mortar rounds began to fall nearby, but not close enough to be dangerous, she saw the officers duck, saw the fear on their faces, and knew the war was lost. Most work, of course, doesn't hold out the regular possibility of dying on the job, but there are plenty of dangers that feel personally threatening. There is always the danger of looking bad, of being bad-mouthed, of costing the company money, or being fired. There is the anxiety that comes from the competition and from market forces beyond one's control. As with many things in life, often the problem is not the problem. The problem is how you react to the problem. If the reaction is that of a deer frozen in the headlights of an oncoming car, the chances of ending up as roadkill are greatly increased. When all employees are focused on the possibility of personal or collective failure, a funereal air saps the energy and optimism necessary for success. At this point, play gives people the emotional distance to rally. When one CEO whom I know gathered employees in the company auditorium to talk about a recent bad quarter, he himself took the blame for the company's performance. He then told the employees that under every seat was a toy dart gun with foam darts and invited them all to take a shot at him. The air filled with flying yellow projectiles, and the atmosphere of the meeting was completely transformed. The CEO then went on to explain how they were going to turn things around, why everything was going to be okay. But the most important point of the talk was nonverbal. The foam darts told everyone that the situation was not so dire. More important, the CEO's playful invitation to take shots at him said that it was okay to have some setbacks, and that it was okay to admit failures, take the hit, and figure out ways to fix them. The foam fusillade was a playful prompt to remind the employees of the joie de combat necessary for success. Sometimes when a situation is really heading south, a moment of imaginative play is the only thing that provides enough distance to see the way out of a predicament. As one high-level executive told me, "Whenever I'm stuck, I try to imagine what someone smarter than me would do, and then I do that." Andrew Grove tells the story of how he and Gordon Moore used imaginative play to turn around Intel at a critical moment in the company's history. Intel had become a success by making memory chips for computers. Yet by the early 1980s, the Japanese were fabricating excellent, cheap memory chips, making it difficult for Intel to make any money. There was a need for the company to find another product line to survive, but the company's whole history and identity was tied to memory chips. Nearly all the engineers and sales staff were organized around the production of memory chips, and the company had recently built a massive, expensive fabrication plant to build yet more memory chips. They were stuck in a corporate rut. One day, Grove and Moore discussed the quandary in Grove's office. They realized that if they didn't solve the problem, the board of directors would fire them and find people who could. They imagined the replacements who would take their jobs and wondered what these super executives might do. Grove looked at Moore and said, "Why don't we do it ourselves?" They then fired themselves, walking out the office door and walking back in as the better and smarter executives who would replace them. Immediately after acting out that little moment of make-believe, the answer was crystal clear. They had to take the company out of the memory chip business, no matter the cost or internal resistance. Eventually, they steered the company into designing and creating microprocessors, for which Intel is now famous. The paradox is that a little distance from a problem, a sense of perspective, a realization that it really matters little in the end if people choose Huggies over Pampers for their kids, can be one of the most important factors in success. If you are working on a campaign to persuade people to use Huggies, it matters a lot to you and your livelihood that mothers agree with you. If you think too much about your own personal investment in the product, you can become too focused on the real but minute advantages that your product has over the competition. 1.5% more absorbency, waist fasteners that unstick and stick again 10 times instead of 8. An active imagination can free you up, however, to create other values to the product. The actual war between Pampers and Huggies was won not by judging the qualities of the products, which were similar, but by creating emotional content in advertising that showed a mother with a dry, happy baby. Imaginative play allows people to step back and see both the emotional and the factual elements of a problem. The beauty of sports is that it embraces the paradox of seriousness and play. We can really care whether the Patriots or the Eagles, the Lakers or the Celtics win the game, and at the same time realize that it is just a game. If our team loses, we may feel down, but there is always a next game, a next season. It matters a lot, but it doesn't matter, which is why sports metaphors abound in business, and why playfulness does not have to involve jokes or goofing off. Sometimes the play may be a friendly competition between teams, or it can be a very private sort of play game that the rest of us never see. A personal competition, for instance, to see how fast we can write a memo, or how many things we can check off our to-do list that day. Or it may be the kind of silent narrative that we used to give ourselves as kids at bat. Now it's the great Mickey Mantle coming to the plate, taking a few leisurely practice swings and settling the bat over his shoulder as he stares down the pitcher. Only now we might channel a personal hero like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, or your company's CEO. The narrative might not be spoken out loud or even consciously recognized, but it is still there. Once we are able to see work as a game full of players, we are better able to accept and make use of a slew of techniques that athletes use to motivate themselves and boost their performance. We might use internal narratives like those I just mentioned. Distraction. I'm going to listen to this great music while I work. Disassociation. I'm not working. I'm on an island in the South Pacific. Or idealization. Everyone will be giving me a standing ovation after I deliver this report. All it takes is a little distance. Work matters, but we can often allow day-to-day events at work to give us more anxiety than they are worth. Getting oneself into a play state, however, masks the urgent purposefulness and associated anxiety of work, increasing efficiency and productivity. There's nothing like true play to promote social cohesion at work. When people play, they become attuned to each other. The more powerful players handicap themselves to keep the game going instead of dominating and controlling it. Groups pull together in pursuit of a common goal, which is why the team approach is often utilized in business. Team building exercises often involve play, solving puzzles, building bridges with cardboard, or going through an obstacle course. We talk about working together as a team, but it might be more beneficial and productive to talk about people playing together as a team. When people graduate from working as a team to playing as a team, they will really allow themselves to compete fully and with gusto against other teams inside and outside the company. Creativity and innovation. By far the biggest reason that companies want to talk to me about play is its role in creativity and innovation. They want to talk about this because many corporations rightly identify play as their most precious commodity. Production matters now, but creativity is the source of all growth. The new products, new techniques, new services, and new solutions to old problems that mark the difference between a company that will thrive and one that will soon be deader than the 8-track tape. What's play got to do with it? After all, isn't necessity the mother of invention? The answer to that question is no. I would say that necessity only sets the stage for invention and innovation. Play is the mother of invention. Polaroid may have really needed a great new product to replace its lucrative consumer photography business, which is now pretty much dead because of digital cameras. But the necessity of finding a replacement didn't lead to one before the company went bankrupt. Polaroid's assets were sold to other companies, and the name Polaroid does live on, but much diminished in comparison with its former grandeur. Necessity is more like a first date. Moving on to become the bride and then the mother of invention requires much more. What are creativity and innovation? Generally, we think of creation as different than creativity. We can create a snowball or a glob of mud, but people don't generally think of those as examples of creativity. We generally think of creativity and innovation as the production of ideas and products that change our world or culture in some lasting way. They may happen on a large scale, as with the invention of the telephone in the 19th century and internet in the 20th century. Or they may occur on a small scale, like when someone comes up with an innovative way of organizing files. Creative people create, yes, but what they create shifts the tectonic plates of our world, changing how we think or do things in ways little or big. The creative process is popularly thought to be mysterious. Highly creative people come in various temperaments, work habits, and educational backgrounds, making it difficult to find a common denominator to their creative processes. But something so valuable has attracted a lot of thought and study in the hope that creativity can be produced at will. Those who study creativity find that the process is by nature contradictory and paradoxical, which is why it can seem so mysterious. Creative people can be simultaneously hardworking and goof-offs. They can have a laser focus on a task, but keep the wide view that lets them see how something fits into the big picture. They are well-versed in their domain of knowledge, painting, physics, literature, the grocery business, etc., but they don't automatically discount new bits of information that don't seem to fit with the accepted canon. Nobel laureate physicist Richard Feynman said that when he was presented with a radical new idea about subatomic particles one time, he said, "That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard." But before he even finished the sentence, he knew that it was probably true. Creative people can escape into the imagination, but also are firmly grounded in reality. Creative ideas are often those that bring together ideas from different domains or fields. Many of the paradoxes of creativity are embodied in play. Creative people know the rules of the game, but they are open to improvisation and serendipity. Play activity can be extremely serious, but in the end, is just a game. Much of play takes place in an imaginative world, but is also firmly grounded in reality. In fact, play promotes mixing fantasy and reality. It is designed to activate functionally diverse brain regions to synergistically integrate their function. Finding people who are innovative and creative is important to a lot of companies. These companies have gathered armies of psychologists and employed batteries of tests that attempt to gauge who is the most creative and why. The recurring problem, as I've said, is that the psychological factors that lead to creativity seem to be all over the map. As a human resource officer working for a major U.S. bank, Dave Stevens spent a lot of time trying to devise what he called an innovation assessment tool to use on potential hires. He employed well-established personality tests like the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator and the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. Using these metrics, it still took years to find out whether an employee was really going to be a creative force in various departments of the corporation. Then he heard a seminar I gave through Vincent & Associates Innovation Practitioner Network, and he began looking at creativity through the lens of play. He found accurate indicators for innovation hiding within emotionally charged early play memories. Using a standard psychological test invented for other purposes, he was able to establish criteria to assay whether prospective employees enjoyed novelty, how they reacted to making mistakes and learning from them, whether they were willing to take risks, and other factors that he had not previously identified as being really important. He found that looking at creativity in this way was likely to produce the quality results that he had been seeking for years. He was able to accurately identify creative people and screen out those for whom innovation and creativity were not their primary nature. As a result of these discoveries, Stevens left the bank and began consulting with other HR executives to share what he had found. Companies have worked to institutionalize creativity in various ways, the most widely known method being brainstorming. As most people know, during brainstorming, a group of people is given a problem or puzzle and then encouraged to think up many solutions, the idea being that some of these will be both new and workable. During brainstorming, the group should focus on quantity of ideas rather than quality. In fact, one of the basic rules of the process is that the quality of an idea isn't considered at all. All judgment or evaluation of the ideas is put on hold. No one is knocked for what seems to be an off-the-wall or crazy suggestion, and there are no brainstorming mistakes. Sorting through the ideas to figure out the good ones will come later. When the brainstorming process goes well, it not only improves the creative process, it also makes people feel smarter, more energetic, more appreciated by their peers. Brainstorming has been credited with more than doubling the productivity of work groups. When brainstorming is going well, it is also play. People joke, laugh almost continuously, and suggest outrageous solutions as well as respectable ones. As with other forms of play, there is diminished sense of self, an openness to improvisation, and a desire to keep the process going. There is a dynamic give and take among group members, and everyone is involved. As in other play, more dominant members of the group will self-handicap to put themselves on equal footing with less dominant members. Time seems to fly by. It doesn't seem like work, appears purposeless, but at the end of the process, there are a number of really good ideas. On the other hand, the results are not always good. Some studies report that brainstorming is no better than asking individuals for ideas. The problem, I think, is that some brainstorming sessions never become playful. Although no one is supposed to criticize, some group members will feel that unspoken criticism is in the air, or a kind of unspoken hierarchy hampers the freedom of expression. Even very creative groups can fall prey to these problems. I am familiar with one company that is known around the world for its creative output, but which has been vexed by brainstorming sessions that have become stagnant. What I've observed is that group members, all smart people, have internalized the expectation that they will always come up with brilliant ideas, which no one can do. There are not supposed to be judgments made about ideas, but they sense that their peers are judging them. The solution that I proposed was consciously establishing activities that set the group up for play, like playing Twister before the brainstorming actually began. When all these smart people play, the brilliant ideas will flow naturally. On a larger scale, companies as a whole often talk about promoting creativity and innovation, but they kill their own best ideas and drive off or shackle the people who come up with them. My colleague, Lanny Vincent, has spent a lot of time and creative energy of his own analyzing why this is. What he finds is that new ideas in companies threaten the existing order. They activate the company's autoimmune system, which protects the existing corporate structure against products that are not invented here or not sold here. I'm sure there were people in Polaroid who saw the handwriting on the wall and wanted to put resources into research and other products such as digital imaging. The problem is that this takes money away from established corporate divisions, who will complain that they are hurting already and that Polaroid will never catch up with companies that already have a market in digital imaging. In Lanny's view, innovative ideas and the groups who come up with them have to be insulated and protected from the normal corporate structure. New ideas are like newborn babies, weak economically and with little promise of quick returns. I know that in the mid-1990s, if most executives thought about the World Wide Web at all, they considered it to have very little business application. If they knew that employees were using company time to explore the internet, they would consider it a waste of time at best, or grounds for firing at worst. Lanny finds that ideas have to be nurtured and supported within companies until they can stand on their own. The people who come up with these ideas have to be insulated from executives who would view their activities as a waste of time, counter to corporate policies, and worse, might convince them that this is so. What's more, even when these ideas are protected, they will most likely not survive unless they are midwifed into existence by a company maverick, someone who has a reputation for tolerating and nurturing wild ideas and methods, but who also has a track record of sound business decisions. Sometimes these mavericks are company founders who have turned day-to-day operations over to more established business leaders. I liken mavericks' psychological role in the evolution of a company to the role of transitional objects in child development. Children take their teddy bear or blanket into new situations as a safe and familiar bridge between dependency on parents and a self-sufficient childhood. The mavericks help the corporate establishment feel comfortable in the foreign world that the innovators inhabit, and help the innovators feel comfortable in the corporate world, yet they really belong to neither. On an individual level, your creativity also needs to be protected, not only from outside critics, but also from your own internal critic. Allow yourself to be abundant in your creativity, at first not making judgments about what you think, feel, or do. Simply play with your ideas, with how you do things. When you are stuck, try imagining 50 impossible solutions, and then let yourself throw out 45. One particularly famous scientist I know told me that the secret to his brilliant ideas is that he has a really big wastebasket. He let himself enjoy thinking up and throwing out 100 bad ideas before finding a single good one. Mastery. There is a great deal of evidence that the road to mastery of any subject is guided by play. Learning a subject by rote can take one only so far. To become a master, the pupil has to go beyond what is known, has to learn what has not been shown by others in the field, Those who study the history of the arts and sciences have many examples of discoveries that came about not through the progression of a planned series of experiments, or at least not a series of experiments that went as planned. Roger Guillemin, in his long quest that resulted in a Nobel Prize, had a hunch that the accepted and proven pituitary control of metabolism, stress, reproduction, and other regulatory hormone-driven physiology was not the whole story. He didn't think it explained the hormonal feedback and regulatory process sufficiently. He was doing microdissections of the pituitary, and as he pondered the possibilities, he discovered that the veins draining blood out of the brain and into the pituitary were much larger in capacity than was needed to drain the arterial pituitary flow into that part of the brain. That's funny, he thought. He soon figured out that the extra volume was from a superhormonal control of the pituitary coming from the brain, the hypothalamus to be exact. Most often, new discoveries and new learning come when one is open to serendipity, when one welcomes novelties and anomalies, and then tries to incorporate those outlying results into the broader field of knowledge. As Isaac Asimov said, "The most exciting phrase to hear in science, the one that heralds new discoveries, is not Eureka, but..." That's funny. The state that most promotes those serendipitous moments and makes us open to anomalies is one of play. We are most likely to say, "That's funny," if, in fact, we are open to appreciating something funny or unexpected. Otherwise, we see only a very unfunny failed experiment. In 1856, an 18-year-old William Henry Perkin tried to synthesize the anti-malaria drug quinine from a petroleum derivative, but failed, ending up with a tarry black mess. The episode could have ended there, but being interested in painting and photography, he saw that when a little of this mess was thinned with alcohol, it would stain cloth bright purple. All cloth dyes at the time were made of natural derivatives that were expensive and often not color-fast. Purple was the rarest and most expensive dye of all. Perkin's aniline dye was the first purple chemical dye, which ushered in a fad for purple clothing that made the 1890s the mauve decade. Finally, and perhaps most important, work that is devoid of play is either boring or a grind. We can get pretty far through sheer willpower, and some people have prodigious powers of perfectionism, self-denial, and suffering. Ultimately, though, people cannot succeed in rising to the highest levels of their field if they don't enjoy what they are doing, if they don't make time for play. Having a fierce dedication to grinding out the work is often not enough. Without some sense of fun or play, people usually can't make themselves stick to any discipline long enough to master it. People always say that you can reach the top by keeping your nose to the grindstone, but as sports performance specialist Chuck Hogan observes, this is not true. People reach the highest levels of a discipline because they are driven by love, by fun, by play. The greatest performers perform as they do and do so with such grace because they love what they are doing, Hogan observes. It's not work. It's play. Tiger Woods hits thousands of golf shots because he loves it, and he loves it because he plays at it, not works at it. Woods told Ed Bradley of 60 Minutes that as a kid he would throw balls into the trees, have them drop randomly in the thick rough, and try to make par anyway, because it was more fun. People I know at Stanford University, where Woods was an undergraduate, told me that he would hit shots with a slice so extreme that the balls would go over the apartments on the left side of the Stanford driving range and then curve back onto the grass. He did this just for fun, because sometimes hitting regular golf shots is boring. On a shoot for a Nike commercial, Woods passed the time while the cameras and lights were set up by bouncing his ball on the end of his 9-iron 40 or 50 times, and then whacking it away without ever letting it touch the ground. The director asked if Woods can do this on camera, and it became a hit commercial. "I enjoy creating," he told Bradley. "I enjoy creating shots." Athletes may not love every minute of training, nor every moment of a game or competition. Sometimes the joy comes from the fantasy of the win. Every athlete I have ever met often feels that they just don't want to start that workout. But when they do, the reason they love what they are doing comes back to them pretty quickly. The work we do has to be the same way. Part of virtually any job has the possibility to be enjoyable, as enthralling and creative as when we were kids building sandcastles on the beach, or flying a kite we created out of sticks, newspaper, and string. The joy has to find its way to us, and us to it. Losing it. If play is so necessary to our work, why do we lose it? The answer is that we are both pushed and pulled away from play. As we get serious about career, get married, have a family, move up the ladder at work, take care of parents, take part in community and religious duties, and work out to stay in shape and prevent health problems, we feel we are inexorably pulled away from any time for personal play. Barbara Brannon, the HR executive I wrote about at the beginning of this chapter, was in this situation. A crisis of some sort is not uncommon for successful people at midlife, but the age for this midlife meltdown has started coming earlier and earlier. People have started talking about a thrisis in the 30s and a quarter-life crisis in the 20s. I've also seen the same pattern in younger people, even adolescents, who have a jam-packed schedule of schoolwork, homework, after-school activities, community volunteering, tutoring, and test prep. I haven't heard a catchy name for it yet, but they too suffer the same crisis of the soul that comes from pouring every moment of your time and every ounce of your being into others' expectations. If anyone goes without play for too long, grinding out the work that is expected of them, they will at some point look at their lives and ask, usually silently and privately, "Is this all there is? Is this what I can expect for the rest of my life?" The acquisition of good grades or a big bonus, if not connected to the heart of life, is dispiriting, even if accolades accrue. For some people, this loss of faith will happen at 16. For others, it will happen at 60. For consummate players, it does not happen. In addition to being pulled away from play, we are pushed from play, shamed into rejecting it by a culture that doesn't understand the human need for it and doesn't respect it. As I've said before, play is seen as something that children do. So playing is seen as a childish activity not done in the adult world. The message is that if you are a serious person doing serious work, you should be serious. Seriously. Most of the time, we have so internalized society's messages about play being a waste of time that we shame ourselves into giving up play. There may be people in our lives who tell us to take it easier, have a little fun, but we just can't allow ourselves to do that. Mark, the restaurant manager, was able to have a fun time and get the job done when he was just a restaurant worker. But as soon as he was promoted to manager, he put himself in a parental role. He felt that he shouldn't be seen to be playing, that this was not what a manager did, regardless of whether or not he could be goofy and do his job. Mark felt it would not be responsible to play. Sometimes I am taken aback by how strongly people block play, by the outright hostility to play. I was recently at a conference in which I spoke about play and was generally basking in the warm reception given me by other attendees. One speaker, who had a highly successful career creating children's television programs, got up after hearing me speak and said, "I can get funding for any project I want to do, but what we really ought to be finding funds for is research on play. This stuff is really important." So it came as a shock to me when I was accosted on my way to get coffee. "Hey, why do you say that you can learn more about play from getting down on the floor and playing with children than you can from reading books?" The guy asking this was perfectly dressed, carried a computer under one arm, was much larger than me, and stood too close. I explained that I was trying to say that you could do all the book learning you wanted, and it would still be hard to understand the emotion of play that you could easily get by experiencing it with kids, who are very pure in their play pursuits. "Well, then you are being inaccurate," he told me. "You're being irresponsible telling people to play. What are you, a hippie?" I felt very uncomfortable. I couldn't be sure he wouldn't punch me or something. Clearly this was someone for whom free play was a threat, and who likely had been prevented from the joy of childhood free play himself. I asked him who in the conference he had found compatible with his viewpoints, and he turned on his heel and hustled away. The conference was a major one, revolving around serious play. Though his aggressiveness was unusual, it was not uncommon. I have experienced too many cold and hostile reactions to play when people listen to a full rendition of its nature and importance, and they slowly realize that they have lived a life deprived of spontaneous play. They are struck by the fact that what love they've had in their lives was conditional and based on their performance. To fully realize this in one sitting as an adult can be overwhelming, too much to bear. The reaction is often an intense, but unconscious, defensiveness, a denial that the fullness of one's life has been wasted. The resulting emotion is usually anger at the deliverer of the message. Joy is our birthright, and is intrinsic to our essential design. For highly competitive, serious people to realize that they have missed this joy can be devastating. Perhaps this fact lies behind the culturally supported idea that people who play are superficial, are not living in the real world, are dilettantes or amoral slackers. If time and circumstances allowed, I would have gently led him through his own play history. I likely would have asked him to begin to look at the sources of his anger, its intensity, inappropriate to the circumstances, and with as much empathy as possible would have pushed open the door to finding out where this anger comes from. When I see people react this way, they are generally people who don't play, who pride themselves on not giving themselves over to play. They define themselves as being no-nonsense people who have been rewarded by their parents, teachers, and bosses for their hard work and accomplishments within a narrow norm. Perhaps they've also been punished for not working hard enough. When I begin to lay out the natural history of play and how necessary it is, for many adults with fixed attitudes about play, the idea of its nature and importance to their lives is too much for them to handle. As they begin to emotionally sense what they have been missing in their lives, have been without the deeply satisfying joy play can bring, their defenses come up. They feel that the idea that we should make a priority of play has to be not only rejected, but also decisively squashed. I've seen this in my own former career in medicine, which is indeed a serious profession. Of course you don't want to be joking around or appear unsympathetic as you examine and diagnose a patient with a very serious disease, but there are a number of doctors, like Patch Adams, who is played by Robin Williams in the movie of the same name, who have shown that humor and playfulness can create a healing connection between patient and physician. There's a saying that laughter is the best medicine, and I think that is often true. Yet most signs of lightheartedness are commonly pounded out of students during the boot camp of medical school, which sometimes seems like a cross between a sleep deprivation experiment and a fraternity hazing. Fortunately, the importance of listening to the patient with empathy has been introduced into contemporary medical school curricula, and studies on sleep deprivation have modified on-call schedules. But as a young doctor in training, I liked the hard work, and found the various courses and ward experiences fascinating. It wasn't the cultural norm then that medical students could be both serious and be playful. As a result, I became a covert player. A fellow student and I had to write a demanding thesis, and yet we wanted to get in shape and spend time outside, so we decided to measure insulin uptake and a few other physiologic changes that might occur during endurance conditioning. We would draw each other's blood before a great run, and then head out for our fun. Sweaty and happy, we would draw a second sample at the run's end. We had a ball, and the results of the thesis were respectable, though it didn't win any prizes. Had we been a bit more enterprising, we would have had fun and won a few prizes. People in offices all over the world also have to take a similarly subversive approach to enjoying their work. Enjoying your work too much might be taken as a sign that you are not working hard enough or don't have enough to do. It might be seen as disrespectful toward people who are overloaded with work, or for those who at least feel overloaded. Happy eagerness about the work might lead others to think you are sucking up to your superiors, are a Pollyanna, or are independently wealthy and don't care if you lose your job. All in all, it's best to take on an energetic but stoic attitude toward the work. Even so, a certain amount of resignation or even cynicism about the workload can take hold. This is nonsense. We can enjoy our work. We can have fun. We can discover how to find as much joy as we do when involved in any project, as much joy as we did when we were a kid making paper airplanes and flying them from the roof. When we lack that feeling of lightness in what we do, it should be taken as a warning sign. It should be as alarming as chest pain or shortness of breath when we climb stairs, a high blood sugar reading, or anemia. If we had a simple test for play like we do for diabetes or high blood pressure, we could look at a number and realize that we are in danger. But we don't have such a test. Instead, we have a smoldering, play-deficient sense that something is missing in life, that we are not getting the feeling of joy and energy that we once did. The question is, how do we get that feeling back? Getting it back. There is no single simple recipe for bringing back a sense of play in your life and work. I can't tell everyone to play 2 games of Scrabble, visit Venice, or try to wiggle your nose, although I suppose that wouldn't be a bad start. There are ways to jumpstart play. As I emphasized earlier, I find that physical activity, movement of any sort, has a way of getting past our mental defenses. National Institute for Play advisor Frank Forensich, who has established a play-based organization called Exuberant Animal, suggests that people start with standing on 1 foot on a wobble board and go on from there. One of our board members at the Institute had his own play epiphany when he found himself alone on the beach and allowed himself to skip. Many years ago, I conducted a study showing that regular physical activity could help seriously depressed women rise out of their depression. This was a year-long study that involved a 5-day-a-week commitment on the part of women who were depressed and unresponsive to antidepressant medication or refused to take it. Many seemed stuck in self-doubting questions such as, "Why didn't my marriage work out?" or, "Why don't I have more friends?" They were referred to this study by local physicians. The beach in San Diego allowed them an uncluttered 2-mile track where, after medical clearance, they were cajoled into sustaining 80% of their maximum cardiac output for 45 minutes 4 times weekly. An exercise expert and I monitored pulse rates and pulse recovery times until the participants could assay their own efforts. The first 3 months were titanic struggles, but then the positive effects of conditioning, exercise, and group solidarity allowed the majority, some had dropped out, to note lessening of their depression and improved overall well-being. For the majority of the participants, the maintenance of endurance conditioning has been necessary to prevent a recurrence of their depression. Even a short walk can lift the spirits. The body remembers what the mind has forgotten. Body play is the first thing that shows up in evolution. Species capable of play show this in their exaggerated jumps, twists, and turns, quirky off-balance to gain balance movements, done apparently because they are fun to experience. It's like the baby hippo in a small Serengeti pond doing backflips in the water, or a baby orangutan swinging upside down like a crazed pendulum. Since movement is the first thing that shows up in our own development, it can also be the first step we take back into play. Playing with pets or children also allows us to get past those same self-censoring impulses that make it so difficult to allow ourselves to play. I've found that a quick film clip of cats playing does as much to get people to understand what play is as a half hour of my lecturing. My daughter once called me to complain that her 8-year-old daughter was in an impossibly foul mood, and nothing she said or did would get her out of it. I suggested she just have her go out in the backyard with the dog and just let them be together for 20 minutes. 10 minutes later, my daughter looked out the window and saw the two of them playing. When my granddaughter came back inside, her mood was completely changed, and it remained that way for the rest of the day. These are all short-term fixes, however. To really regain play in your life, you will need to take a journey back into the past to help create avenues for play that work for you in the present. This can be done through a complete play history, or it can be done by simply sitting and remembering, and often visualizing, something you did in the past that gave you the sense of unfettered pleasure, of time suspended, of total involvement, of wanting to do this again and again. Remember how that made you feel? Remember and feel that emotion and hold on to it, because that is what's going to save you. The memory of that emotion is going to be the life raft that keeps you from drowning. It can be the rope that lifts you out of your play-deficient well. Your task will be to find activities that allow you to recreate that feeling. This is what Barbara Brannan calls heart play, the kind of play that speaks to your heart and soul. In her book, The Gift of Play, Why Adult Women Stop Playing and How to Start Again, she describes how she looked at her life and realized that her best memories of play in her childhood were outdoor activities. Her family lived in the country, where she loved spending full days hiking in the woods or swimming at a nearby lake. That was her heart play. Her husband was someone who enjoyed indoor activities, reading and listening to music or board games. Barbara loved her husband and naturally wanted to spend recreational time with him, but she realized that her husband's heart play was never going to be hers. Once she realized that she would need time for her heart play and started acting on that realization, she began to experience true play again. She began to feel an excitement with life that she had forgotten. Play became infused in her work. Setting out to remember those feelings can be dangerous. It can seriously upend your life. If Barbara's marriage wasn't as strong as it was, her husband might have felt she was pulling away when she went on long hikes by herself. Jason, the jeweler I described at the beginning of the chapter, realized that what he really enjoyed about his craft was working with people to understand what they were looking for, what they needed. He realized that he really wanted to spend more time doing that, and so went back to graduate school to get his PhD in clinical psychology. It wasn't an easy road to take. There was a lot of coursework, and it cost a lot of money, but in the end, he found himself doing what he truly loved. When people are able to find that sense of play in their work, they become truly powerful figures. It can be transformative. I've spent a little time working on a project with Al Gore, and I'm familiar with his past. He grew up as the well-off child of a United States senator, often living in hotels in Washington, D.C., but his father didn't want him to be spoiled, so he had him work on the farm in Tennessee during the summers. The feeling I got from Gore was that he felt the need to always be responsible and dutiful, so he seldom allowed himself to really cut loose and play, at least not in any public setting. My feelings were confirmed when he was running for president. People called him stiff. They sensed that something was being held back. When he lost the presidential election, and after an understandable period of decompressing, and after taking stock of his priorities, Gore changed. It was as if he was freed to finally pursue what really fueled his soul. He put together a presentation on global warming that became a movie and a book, An Inconvenient Truth. In the movie and in person, Gore's joy and his emotion came out. You didn't get the sense that he was holding back anymore. At a conference I attended, Gore made his global warming presentation, and later, one of the most successful motivational speakers of all time, Tony Robbins, told him, "If you had spoken with that passion back in 2000, I believe you would have decisively beaten that guy. Remember the feeling of true play, and let that be your guiding star. You don't have to be irresponsible or walk away from your job and your family to find that feeling again. If you make the emotion of play your North Star, you will find a true and successful course through life, one in which work and play are bound together." As James Michener wrote in his autobiography, "The master in the art of living makes little distinction between his work and his play, his labor and his leisure, his mind and his body, his information and his recreation, his love and his religion. He hardly knows which is which. He simply pursues his vision of excellence at whatever he does, leaving others to decide whether he is working or playing. To him, he's always doing both." Chapter 6. Playing Together. Gail and Jeff, both 45, are full professors at Boston University. Their original shared interest in art history brought them together 15 years ago. Their early years together provided a heady brew of intellectual challenge, emotional exploration, and romantic passion. They once described themselves as best buddies who really like sex. But after 10 years of marriage, plus 3 kids and demanding jobs, their intellectual companionship has dwindled. Even thinking about sexual interaction brings up a lot of issues. They now describe themselves as burned out and may be wondering how they got into this downer state of being. They are not sure they even like each other anymore. One Friday night, however, they find themselves duct-taped to each other hand and foot, squirming like Siamese twin snakes across the floor with 3 other faculty couples. They race toward a line drawn across the floor at the far end of the large community center common room, where a play therapist conducts the couple's play shop. The laughter is contagious, raucous, and virtually uncontrolled. Sweaty and exhilarated, still laughing to the point of collapse, they reach the finish line. That night, Gail and Jeff make love for the first time in 5 months, and awaken in the morning as new friends. The change came because they put themselves in a situation in which they had the opportunity to viscerally connect for the first time in a long time. The silly and absurd shared task let them drop their guard and be fully with each other. They were able to play. In the course of taking play histories, I have interviewed a lot of couples, some troubled and some not. Among the troubled couples, some were able to relight the fires of love and some couldn't. The defining factor among couples who were able to find romance again, and even to find new fields of emotional intimacy previously unexplored, was that they were able to find ways to play together. Those who played together stayed together. Those who didn't either split or, worse yet, simply endured an unhappy and dysfunctional relationship. What has become clear to me now is how play can become the cornerstone of all personal relationships, from everyday interactions to long-term love. In fact, I would claim that sustained emotional intimacy is impossible without play. This is true not only for married bliss, but for continued vitality in long-term friendships. In the beginning. To understand why play is at the foundation of all personal relationships, we need to go back to the very first love relationship between mother and